On the Empire podcast this week, the second greatest living Northern Irishman, big Liam Neeson, drops by to natter about a walk among the tombstones, while five members, five, count them, of the Riot Club descend upon us as well, and it all gets a little out of hand. All that and usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast that doesn't want to get political, but we get to keep Karen Gillan, don't we? Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, the 47,628th greatest living Northern Irishman, in case you were wondering. The first is, of course, Brendan Rodgers. Welcome. He's the manager of Liverpool Football Club.
Okay.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week I'm joined by Helen O'Hara, the joint 47,628th greatest living Northern Irish person, which means we're just behind Roy Walker, Eamon Holmes, and that bloke who walked off Bake Off in a huff. But crucially, and I cannot stress this enough, Helen, we're ahead of Mae McFetridge.
That is good
news. That's an inside joke for Northern Irish people there. Also joined by Dan Jolan, the world's 182nd greatest living Colin Farrell lookalike. Sorry, that's a misprint. That should read the 182nd greatest Colin Farrell living in a skip lookalike.
You know those people on Leicester Square that draw, like, you know, really bad cartoon drawings of you?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
If I sat down in front of one of those guys and he did one of those drawings of me, that drawing is Colin Farrell.
Right.
Right. Let's move on to some questions. By the way, quick, get well soon to Ali Plum, who was going to join us this week, but is poorly, so please
man
get well.
Flu.
I got the black lung, Bob. Here's some lovely questions. You've been sending them in. Here is a question from a man known only as Wayne. Via email. Hi, from sunny Sydney, Australia. I'm not going to do an accent because he could be an expat.
Sure.
He could be Scottish. We don't know. I need to think of a funny nickname to put on the back of my high school graduating jersey. Do you guys, that's us, have any suggestions as to any film/pop culture/anything related puns based on the name Wayne? It needs to be less than 15 letters. Thanks so much. I'm a huge fan of the podcast. Wayne.
Can I field this one?
Of course.
Please
you can
do.
Okay, I've got Hard Wayne, Purple Wayne, Tears in the Wayne, Wayne of the Dragon, How the West Was Wayne, The Wayne Ultimatum, The Wayne Supremacy, The Wayne Identity, Wayne's World, Wayne's World 2, The Man with Two Waynes, Days of Wayne and Roses, and Singing in the Wayne.
You forgot Chubby Wayne.
Oh, Chubby Wayne.
No disrespect, Wayne. That's not in any way a comment on you. I'm sure you're not chubby at all.
I love Wayne of the Dragon. That's my favourite. But have you considered Enter the Wayne?
Wayne of the Gun?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no. High school guns, not a good combo.
Yeah, the Wayne Neal suspects. Wayne Ablanca. The Wayne Shank Redemption. The Shawshank Wayne Redemption.
No, you're just saying the word Wayne for no reason.
No, I'm Wayne. You're Wayne.
Is there a Batman thing? Is there like a Wayne Manor, Wayne Enterprises?
Why would there be a Wayne to do with Batman?
Well, because, you know, there's that obscure businessman in Gotham City called Bruce Wayne.
Oh.
He sometimes, like, appeared in the show.
Oh, right, okay. No, I didn't know that. Obviously, the Duke, John Wayne.
Yeah.
You could put the Duke on the back and people wouldn't mess with you because no one messed with John Wayne.
Good stuff.
Apart from
I like
all the
it.
People who did and sure. All the movies and stuff. But we must move on to the next Wayne. Here's the one from Twitter @Rob_Place. Wayne, we hope you helped. We hope you did. Rob Place asks, what are your favourite slaps in movies?
I would say that the best one is in The Naked Gun, where Priscilla Presley goes to slap Leslie Nielsen. And she slaps him with one hand and he catches it. She tries with the other hand and he catches it. And he is then slapped by a third hand.
Yes.
And no one knows where it came from. So that is my favourite by quite a long way.
That's amazing.
Sorry, Helen, that's a good one. But I think my one is objectively the best slap.
Oof.
In movie history.
Oof.
Okay? There's nothing that beats this. And I think that can be backed up. Ace in the Hole. Chuck Tatum, played by Kirk Douglas. He's with Jan Sterling's Lorraine. And she wants to get out of that dump and she thinks he's her way out. And she's grinning at him in one scene. And he tells her to wipe the smile off her face. And there's like some sexual frisson and everything. And we think there's going to be a kiss coming. And she thinks there's going to be a kiss coming.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, oh, how are you going to wipe it off my face? And then from out of nowhere, he slaps her really hard and nastily right across the face. And it's a really nasty, horrible shock. And if you're in any doubt whatsoever that his character in this film is a complete and utter callous bastard, then all those doubts are gone at this moment. And the slap also receives a cameo appearance in Clint Eastwood's Jersey Boys, which was released earlier this year.
Oh, yeah.
They're all watching it on telly.
They are, yes.
Yes.
All right, but slapping people, don't do it.
Don't do it. It's a bad slap.
There's no good slaps. In film noir, you know, the slap was the biggest weapon in the arsenal of many a tough guy.
And also a femme fatale.
Yeah. There's nothing like a slap to just really get the blood pumping around the face.
Jessica Rabbit had a good one, as I remember as well.
Mm. Yeah, it's a good way to, you know, to show, how dare you, outraged, boom, slap. I've got a couple. I love a good slap in the movie. Airplane has a cracking one.
Yeah.
Also from Sucker, Abraham Sucker, where the lady on the plane gets hysterical. And a whole group of people line up to slap her, shake her, then slap her. And then gradually it pans along the line of people and they have baseball bats and like crowbars and all sorts of stuff. Very, very funny. I love... I can't remember if this is... I didn't look this one up before because this has just occurred to me. Could be a punch, but I think it's a slap in Raising Arizona when Holly Hunter slaps Nicolas Cage in the car and it leads to the single greatest facial expression of Nicolas Cage's career.
Wow.
They're driving along in the... I'm not kidding. I think people who know that film will know what I'm talking about. They're driving along in a car... He says something, she slaps him silly, he turns towards the camera and does this incredible Tex Avery, Chuck Jones, slapstick, Warner Brothers cartoon expression on his face that is just absolutely perfect and one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And I cannot let a conversation about slaps in the movies go without mentioning Eddie Griffin as TJ in the Deuce Bigelow saga, who likes to bitch slap his man whores, his he bitches, with his pimp hand. Oh. Bam! Feel my pimp hand is his catchphrase.
Don't make me he bitch man slap you.
Don't make me he bitch man slap you. He keeps him in line with the back of his hand. Amazing stuff. There are tons, absolutely tons. And as ever, we're not trying to be definitive here. So do send in your very, very favorite slaps to us. Send them in to our Twitter account where you can find us as Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast and you can email them to us, podcast@empireonline.com, as Wayne did earlier on when he sat down with his Wayne and he wrote a nice Wayne. And you can Facebook us as well. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine. And if you're Bono, you can just insert your question into our heads unbidden, just whenever you like. It's fine. It's totally up to you. But there are loads more.
Can I just say that slapping is wrong? We don't condone slapping in any way, shape or form, except when Chris is being naughty in the office. Sometimes a little slap across the back of his legs shuts him up.
That's not true, Dan.
I just spray his nose with water.
Oh, do you?
That also seems to work.
Oh, I've not tried that. Yeah.
Hey, Dan, what happens if I touch that?
Ow! There you go.
That's me putting line. There's a great one where there's like a woman crying, shut up, and then... You know, she slaps someone really quickly and then they kiss. What's that one? Anyway, doesn't matter. Should we move on or should we ask
every movie made before the 1950s? I don't know.
Oh, no, it's a recent one as well. Oh, God. That question's really good, but I do wonder if we've missed some absolute belters.
No, we haven't. Ace in the Hole is the ace in the hole.
So that's how you get in touch with us, not just to pull us up on what we've missed in terms of movie slaps. Also, last week we went through a list of the British Expendables, people who'd be in the British Expendables, whether it be a Brit Expendables movie. A lot of people yelling Sean Bean at us. Yes, Sean Bean would obviously be part of the Expendables, but he would also obviously die in the first 3 minutes. So what's the point?
Spoiler.
BMO dog. No, wait, that's not him. That's not him. That's Julian
I love Barrett. Swans. That's him.
What's the colour of the roof of the boathouse at Hereford? You ever seen that? Ronan?
No.
Robert De Niro.
No, I have, but I don't remember that.
It's one of my favourite lines in that movie where Robert De Niro basically knows that Sean Bean's an imposter. And he does so by asking him what's the colour of the roof of the boathouse at Hereford, and the way Robert De Niro pronounces Hereford as Hereford always stuck with me.
Oh, it's upsetting.
Like I can't believe a Sean Bean didn't go, Bobby, mate,
Hereford,
it's Hereford, mate. O2, see what you can do. Time now for first guest, or should I say guests? Of course, the Riot Club, based on the play Posh, is about a very exclusive students association that gets very, very out of hand. And it's a veritable statham, that is the collective now, a statham of the finest young British acting talent around. And our Ali Plum, God bless him, he's sick now, but he was well then, went along and wrestled, not literally, with five of them at the same time. Max Irons, Sam Claflin, Douglas Booth, Holiday Granger, and Jessica Brown Findlay. The results are riotous and not a little posh. Prepare yourself for lots of received pronunciation. Enjoy.
As you can hear, we're at a table. Water's being poured. I am breaking the record. Yeah, we are live right now.
It's honestly water.
For the Empire podcast. Could you guys please, as we break a record from the number of people we've interviewed at once, say your name
At once?
Not at once. Say your name and the poshest word you know.
Holiday Granger, legend.
Max Owens, chunder.
Desmond Finney, gosh.
Gosh, it's just the poshest word you know.
I don't know, I couldn't think of anything.
Douglas Booth, chateaued.
Could you use chateaued in a sentence for me?
I got absolutely chateaued last night.
Hooray!
Yeah, or I should say,
huzzah!
Huzzah, yeah, huzzah.
I was going to say huzzah.
Oh, shit.
Oh, damn it. Bruins, absolutely. Oh, sorry, and I'm Sam, the huzzah.
One thing that this film taught me was the phrase, oh my wow.
Oh my wow. I know. Yeah, that's which pretty special. Point phrase.
Which I've horridly been using occasionally, and I must stop.
Yeah. Oh, no, don't. Bring no, it. Come I on, must. Bring it in, dog.
I'm still
bring
disappointed
it
by the amount of woofs that didn't make it.
No.
The amount of times we were just like walking around set going, woof, woof. 2 months of yeah.
Off. With a prep for this, how do you prepare for being posh? The guys that were posh here.
I mean, you have to really start at the beginning when they were kids. So we went to Eton, and we kind of met this young 18-year-old lord, and he was really charming, but he was really nice. But
they were good at that age, aren't they?
Yeah. And then we learned about this thing called Pop, which is this club they have at Eton, which pretty much popular kids nominating other popular kids to be in a club where they get their own clubhouse, and they get to wear their own special waistcoat to set them apart and stuff. And this is breeding entitlement into kids from a very young age. I suppose that for a very small the minority, that seed is enough to create the characters that we see in this movie.
It was an eye-opening experience, I think, wandering around Eton for the day.
Yeah.
Just like the rules and regulations that kind of surround that school and the reputation that it has. You know, it was quite literally seeing how the other half live, you know, from someone who was not from that upbringing. you know, but it was really informative, I think. And some of the other guys, you had the opportunity to meet someone from like a previous club similar to this. So I think, you know, it was sort of, yeah, we had people on hand to show us the ropes is what I'm trying to say.
We thought the script wasn't going to, we thought people can't possibly be like this. And we met the real people and we had to make it worse.
Yeah, I think that the original screenplay based from the play was taken up to Cambridge, shown to students, and they came back with
tips.
It's not extreme enough, basically. The antics in the script as they are not extreme enough. So we had to up the ante a bit.
I forget who does it, but who's the person that opens a champagne bottle with a sword?
This guy.
Dougal.
The barrage.
How many times did you get that one right or wrong? Because I would love to do that once in my life.
You know what? I have to admit that
they
helped me out a little bit. They pre-helped. Look, we were on a very tight schedule. This is a British independent film. We did not have a lot of time. And actually, it was very stressful. But yeah, and actually, to start with, because, and also what they put in it wasn't champagne.
It was like washing up liquid.
And I sprayed it all in Sam's face. And your eyes were stung. And you actually swallowed some of it as well,
yeah,
didn't you?
It was really,
I think you thought it was champagne. And it was washing up liquid and water.
Was it a good year for it, at least?
It was well, ask him, he drank it.
It was vintage. It was vintage.
It
was vintage. Yeah.
Solid bubbles, bro.
Solid bubbles.
You
so contradictory. I love that.
You shot a lot of this film, I think, in Winchester. Is that right?
We shot some of it in Winchester. Yeah.
When you guys were kicking back in a non-Riot Club way, what did you guys get up to? Because I get the impression you had a good time making this film.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think Winchester kind of allowed us sort of
debaucherous
nights out.
Sorry, it was my
21st
birthday in Winchester. It was a great time in Winchester.
Yeah. what did you do?
What did you do?
I don't know. What did we do? We're in some hotel.
We played bowls.
Drinks, we played bowls. Drinks and I can't remember.
We had dinner.
Sounds like a good night.
It sounds crazy. But no, socially, this job was amazing. It's very rare that you get to work with nine people, other people your age. Well, actually, nine boys and three beautiful, wonderful, very talented female actors.
Well done. Nice little back.
That was very good.
Really Gordon.
And Gordon. No, of course. Yeah. But I'm talking about people our age. It's rare to work with people your age, that many.
If we could go around the table, what is the poshest role you've ever played before this one? What could rival this?
I played the King of England. That'd do it.
That's pretty good.
He's like totally top.
I suppose my first ever job, I played an earl.
I was in that too.
You played a king's son.
Are you a prince? He was an earl.
I was a prince. I was alive in one scene, killed in the next, and then ghosted in the next one. I wasn't in it very long. I was a prince.
But I had to come to your character as the prince to ask for my land back, basically.
And I said, yes?
Yes.
Oh, great.
If you win it back.
It's so memorable, this show.
So I had a prince, a king, an earl.
I've played a pope's daughter and a baroness.
Oh, wow. Holy wow. Granger.
The baroness.
And baroness. Oh, yeah.
Did anybody do any Austin Powers just to make other people corpse?
I think that was just...
That was you.
That was my Scotch accent.
Austin Lyle is Austin Powers.
I can't watch this movie in the same way again.
No. Yeah. Oh, me. I played a lady.
Well, there you go.
Well, like, not just like, I mean, a prince. I played a lady. I'm very diverse.
How did you train yourself for that?
Well, I don't know.
I rocked up and then...
I just, yeah. No, so that was that. I played a female woman who was also a lady.
Wow. This is incredible. Acting, right?
I know.
Yeah, just...
Our range is diverse.
And I think Freddie was Louis the 13th.
In real life?
Yeah, he was, for a while. when he was 8, he went back in time.
But he's now the 40.
Good. In Three Musketeers.
Yes, that's right.
He was hilarious in that. Yeah. Best thing in that film.
I don't think enough people have seen just how preposterous that film is.
Yeah, and how hilarious he is in it.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, him, hilarious. Which is the biggest tantrum, doesn't he? And
yes.
He stomps out the room in his high heels. It's quite wonderful.
I wish he were here so I could tell him how great he looks in a wig.
Yeah.
He really, really does. Because this is an amazing thing. If you go to your Wikipedia page, it says not to be confused with Sir Douglas Allan Booth, 3rd Baronet. How often are you confused with this man?
That's great.
I haven't seen that. I have no idea. That's
you
the first time.
You don't jump to your Wikipedia page every morning?
No, unfortunately not. It probably says some awful things.
I'm going to have to read it now.
Please do.
I mean, who is this person? Did you look them up?
He is an Anglo-American aristocrat, and I promise you this is true. He is best known for writing a lot of Scooby-Doo's scripts throughout the 70s
and
80s.
Joking.
I am not joking. Your nemesis writes Scooby-Doo.
But do you reckon it was his team that, like, please... don't get these two mixed up. Because this guy is really important.
Well, I want to meet. Is he alive?
No, I don't know. I'll look that up.
Don't put yourself. I'll do it.
No, don't worry.
Don't spend your day.
It's not that.
The next Empire podcast in search of Lee Douglas Booth.
Right, we found him. Now, is there a particularly standout day, possibly outside of the scene, that when you were shooting it? Because you had fun in Oxford, I'm gathering, as well, because you did shoot there. You were in Magpie Lane.
Magpie Lane. Is that where he's standing and I help him?
It's a very tender moment there.
Yeah.
Because essentially, I don't want to give away too much, but Sam's character gets mugged.
Yeah.
In a rather superb way.
Yeah, it's a very good mugging.
It's a good mugging. Yeah.
And there's a lovely shot of your head on a pavement.
Yeah, my head definitely hit the ATM machine.
It must have hurt.
Yeah, it definitely... Well, I think they told me not to.
The ATM machine.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, the ATM.
Oh!
Busted.
That shows he's not
quite busted. Yeah, I bet he's not quite. The closest to any character that I am in this is the mugger. Yeah.
Did you turn around and go, no, you're mugging wrong.
You're mugging me. You're mugging me all wrong.
And that was a reference to someone, if people haven't seen the film, listening to that, I have no idea what we just laughed about. That's a reference to something Sam says when he's being mugged.
When he's being mugged, he does point out that a PIN number should be just PIN.
PIN.
If you're not the same personal identification, number.
Yeah,
exactly.
Number twice.
And bringing up...
They're wondering not to.
How do you ring the lines?
That's a solid reason to mug.
If I was ever going to mug somebody, I would...
Yeah, I love the idea of a judge in a court of law just going, look, I appreciate that you've lost your money, but you were being a total knob. Yeah. It was bound to happen. Now, also, there's fencing in this film. How much were you winging that?
I was winging it quite badly.
I was winging it quite badly.
No, I did do like three rehearsals, but it was my 21st birthday the day before, so I was a bit sore. But it was...
That sounded sinister.
I know.
is that what happened?
I was preempting that with the laugh.
Yeah, no. We went out in Winchester. Woo-woo. But no, it was good. It was fun. I mean, it was okay. I did an all right job, didn't I?
Yeah, I thought so.
Okay.
I believed it. I hope you got to keep something. I was wondering what mementos you guys kept, because there's a lot of like regalia. Did you get to keep the suits, the livery?
We did
get
hit flask. We all got
did you?
Hit flask, yeah. Which I actually took to Toronto and forgot to show you. I thought I was going to take it out, but I forgot.
Oh, that explains a lot.
Yeah. Oh. But what were we saying?
I mean, is that good in an interview to whip out a hip flask? I mean, that's
it's not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing.
It makes the right impression.
Okay, all right.
I love a good hip flask on this collection.
But you know, you didn't get to keep the suits because the suits are extraordinary. There's that great photograph of the whole gang, not gang, the club.
No, but it is a gang.
It is a gang.
And which I find, which we've been actually saying, which is really interesting, there was an Oxford student who wrote an article about how in films gangs are often shown at the bottom of society and like struggling to get up. And then this is a gang.
Yeah.
And you don't really see films about gangs at the top of society, people who are already sitting on the very top, and you know, and it's quite interesting. It was a really interesting paper written by in the Oxford student, actually.
Blimey.
I'm not surprised that the initiation period didn't involve the rest of the gang singing the once famous song, "Wanna Be in My Gang, My Gang."
Yes.
My gang. It should have happened.
No, it should have
happened. It was in the first draft.
And was it? You tweeted.
Yeah.
I was wondering, with this, the centerpiece of this film being this massive, I'm going to call it colloquially a party. What was the rap party like? Did you feel like you had to really bring it? Because if you don't really bring it, it's like, so I'm Bovril at 9, I'm off home.
One person around this table really brought it.
Yeah.
In spectacular fashion.
Is it the man closest to 21?
Yeah, but I always bring it in spectacular fashion, don't I?
You brought the sunrise in spectacular.
Yeah, well, wow. I got thrown out of some pub by some bouncer dressed as Where's Wally. I'm joking, and I think I was telling. I think I was telling him he was dressed as Where's Wally, which we really did not appreciate. I think he was wearing a red and white stripy t-shirt. What is that about?
Who's I think we can end the interview there. Yeah.
I love a stripe.
Was he a bouncer or just a guy who didn't like you?
He was a bouncer.
Yeah, we were all. Sort
we were all
out.
Dancing on a table, and he didn't like us dancing.
Oh,
on the table. You remember that?
We were dancing.
We were dancing so well, Joe.
Yeah.
We were
having was a this
time.
A Where's Wally club?
No, it was a pub in Nottingham.
I know, but the funny thing is you can't find it. Sorry, that was awful.
Oh, that was actually really
it was really good, but what happened was that, you know when Jimmy Carr tells a great joke and halfway through it goes, no, that was crap.
I couldn't remember where that pub was. You know, actually can't remember where we were.
My jokes are quite mysterious.
That was actually really good. I like that joke.
That's my quote of the interview so far. My jokes are quite mysterious.
But then we all had the after party in a house that had no furniture,
which was a very spooky feeling.
Yeah.
Is that another name for a pub? A house with no furniture.
No, it was a producer's friend's house who he was staying in, and I don't think we were really allowed to be there.
Well, they
called the police.
Is it really?
Yeah, the police.
Did I just left them? Oh, damn.
How satisfying is it to throw glasses on the floor? Because I got the impression that you were doing it not because the director told you to. You were just doing it.
I mean, they weren't real glasses, were they?
No, they were like sugar glass, which I actually find more enjoyable.
They break. Yeah.
They just explode. Like they quite literally explode in all shapes and sizes.
But if you show a champagne sugar glass, sometimes you throw it like that and it snaps before it even leaves your hands.
You're that strong.
Yeah.
I break stems with my merest thoughts. Yeah. Now, in the play, the original play, there is some a cappella, I gather, that's involved.
There is.
Were you ever worried when you signed up for this that you might be obliged to sing?
Again, I thought it was... that was the only reason I signed
you
up for
it. You do sing in the film.
It was amazing the amount of people that didn't know the national anthem, myself included. There were quite a few of us.
Well, there was a certain...
The whole thing.
The whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows, like...
The first two lines.
Yeah, to try and get us to all sing it in time was an absolute... I don't know how. We had to eventually get Ollie Alexander, who's in this now very successful band, years and years, to sort of, like, sing along to get us to go do the right... Yeah.
It was like a tonal starter.
Yeah, because we were so useless.
Sam down and octaves.
Was it like the difference between "God Save the Queen" and "God Save Our Queen"? There was one line we kept all getting mixed up.
I remember like nearly an hour discussion with voice coaches about whether you were saying "R" or "Our."
Yeah,
I don't want to speak on behalf of our beloved monarch, but I genuinely don't think she minds.
So what happens when you've got a different accent?
If someone's singing about you, those saying how you're great.
I know. The vocal coach is really good.
She's got her own theme tune.
She's got her own bloody house that's in the middle. Anyway, thank you so much to everyone for agreeing. We've been in a round table. I feel this is very royal. And would you like to all just say goodbye to your microphones and also to our listeners of the Empire Podcast?
Goodbye, microphone.
Goodbye, Mr. Microphone.
Goodbye.
This is so lovely.
Bye, microphone. Sorry. About the joke.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Thanks, you guys. See you next time.
Thank you.
Bye.
Can I keep him?
Of course.
Yeah. To my mind.
He's so cute. Oh, he's so tiny.
Riotous stuff. Let's move on to movie news. We have bloody tons of the stuff to get through this week. Where should we begin?
Let me just begin by mentioning that we have unveiled our subs cover for the next issue a little bit early this month because it's a very, very special one. Christopher Nolan himself was involved in handpicking the image for our Interstellar cover, and it shows Matthew McConaughey's Cooper in all his glory, in all his spacesuit, on a very alien-looking world. So if you haven't seen that already, do check it out. It is also going to be the poster for the film now, and we also have that on the site, so do have a look at it. We will have all the information about that issue of the magazine, which is a very exciting one, next week when it actually comes out.
Dan, of course, was on set and wrote every word of that coverage.
Pretty much. Spaceships and robots and space, oh my.
Good. Is it worth looking forward to, Dan?
I think it's going to be amazing. Yeah. I mean, you know, from what I've seen.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be amazing.
I meant your feature, not
Oh, sorry. I thought you were the film itself.
The film's given.
Well, you know, I've people who have read the feature have said they liked it, so I'm pleased with it.
And that's you, your wife,
and
Ian Nathan.
Okay.
All at the same time.
The two most important people in your life.
Yes. But yeah, no, it was great. I was invited onto the sets. I got to wander around the sets and sit inside the spaceships and everything. I sat where Matthew McConaughey sits in the film. I got to see lots of concept art. I got to see a little bit of the film itself a few months later, which I was asked not to describe anything of, because, you know, Christopher Nolan is a very secretive man. So that's fair enough. But I was very impressed.
Come back next week and tell us all about it. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a lot of fun. To make sure you never miss a subscriber's cover, you can subscribe to Empire Magazine right now. There are incredible deals out there. Go to greatmagazines.co.uk and there we are. Nice and simple. Cool. Right. What else?
Well, there's some sort of interlinked movie news this week. Why don't you start with your story, Dan, and then I will follow that up with two others.
All right.
Flow from it.
It's like a tag team of stories.
Mm. Yeah. Well, this is one's about Skull Island. Now, as I think anyone knows, Skull Island is the home of one Mr. Kong, first name King. First piece of casting news for this film, and this is exciting, it's Tom Hiddleston.
Ooh.
Tom Hiddleston's going to be going to Skull Island. Well, we assume that. So there's not a huge amount of detail about it at the moment. So we don't know who Tom is playing. Our guess, I think, is that he's some kind of, you know, intrepid explorer slash hunter kind of guy. But we don't know even the time period that this film is set. I mean, this could be as far back as, you know, this could be 18th century. You know, he could be a swashbuckler for all we know. Or this could be, you know, Victorian era. They could be playing on the idea of, you know, the spread of empire in the Victorian era or something like that. So it is going to be before the 1930s. And another interesting element is that it's Legendary are doing this, who also did Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And the scriptwriter is Max Borenstein, who is the credited scriptwriter on Godzilla. So could there be some kind of crossoverness brewing?
So sort of a Monster Island thing, almost.
Yeah, maybe.
There have been crossovers in the past, haven't there, between Godzilla and King Kong?
Yes, they have. He has fought King Kong. Godzilla has fought King Kong.
That's certainly something that there was a lot of speculation, because obviously shared universes are now the in thing.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of speculation at Comic-Con when Skull Island was unveiled that King Kong and Godzilla might crop up at some point in the same movie. Of course, the fact that Godzilla is about, how tall is he now in this one? 300 feet?
Yeah, about
like
that.
Yeah, and King Kong is not that. That Godzilla could use him to maybe just clean
his bottom.
His bottom with and move on.
Mm.
I'm not sure his arms are long enough, really. Godzilla's arms might not reach his bottom.
Maybe he should curl up King Kong in his tail.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Under. I don't know how prehensile his tail is, though.
No.
If we ever did Pint of Milk with Godzilla and we asked him how hairy his arse is on a scale of 1 to 10, he would say 10, because King Kong is wedged in there. So that would be the answer to that one. Yeah, really interesting. At the Skull Island teaser, which they unveiled at Comic-Con, had a very English actor voiceover, and we were all desperately trying to place a voice. I do wonder if it was T. Hiddy.
The time,
but I'm pretty sure we would have guessed which voice that was. But it's very, very interesting that he's done this.
Yeah, I can imagine a Victorian sort of steampunky looking explorer's tale could be quite cool.
I can imagine Tom Hiddleston in a pith helmet.
Oh yeah, easily.
Yeah,
yeah. Born to wear one.
Yes.
But that does actually bring us on to a couple more stories that are kind of related. Now, Tom Hiddleston, as you may remember, was being targeted for the lead in the new version of Ben Hur. He was being courted, he was being talked up for the role. Now, he appears to be out of the picture because of Skull Island, apart from anything else. And the latest story is that Jack Houston will be playing that role. So he would be stepping into what could have been the sandals of T. Hiddy, as we are currently calling him, apparently. And playing the Jewish prince who is friends with a Roman growing up, but who is, through his machinations, sold into slavery and then comes back for revenge in the classic climactic chariot race.
Blimey.
Yar. So that's going to be Jack Houston. Now, the interesting thing about that, in turn, is that Jack Houston had been rumoured as one of the contenders for Doctor Strange. And one would imagine that this rather puts him out of the running for that, because probably I would have thought the timings would sort of be incompatible. Now, there might be some wiggle room there. He could still be in the frame for both. But it might mean that the casting for Doctor Strange is open again, or that Joaquin Phoenix is now the front runner.
I still can't see, I'll probably be proved wrong within seconds of this podcast being launched. I still can't see Joaquin Phoenix, of all people, signing up for a franchise. I just can't see it.
Yeah, it does seem a little unlikely.
I mean, this is a man who shuns publicity, and he'd be required to be out there doing the publicity trail. That's just one reason why I think he wouldn't do it. I think there are probably a myriad other reasons. But this is interesting. I feel, and I don't want to prejudge movies.
Sure.
We don't do that. I feel that Hiddleston's dodged a bullet here.
With Ben-Hur?
Yeah. I really do. Timur Bekmambetov, I just cannot see this. Yes, he can do epic. Yes, he's crazy in his own way. But I don't know. I think there's just something about him. I think he's too overblown as a director. I can see what his Ben-Hur is going to look like, and I'm already cringing a little bit.
Maybe he can get back to, you know, more like he was with Night Watch, where I think he showed some real kind of restraint as well as some flair. And, you know, I don't know. I'm not excited by Ben-Hur. The period and the story doesn't really float my boat particularly. But at the same time, who doesn't love a little bit of Romans?
True, but also I hope they're not trying to launch a franchise here. I hope it's not, you know what I mean, it's like Ben-Hur and then spin-offs, and there's a Ben-Hur shared universe, a Ben-Hur universe. I just keep it one movie, make it long.
You know one important character in Ben-Hur?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, our Lord Jesus Christ,
the greatest hero of them all.
Yes, indeed. But the funny thing, if you go that chariot race isn't the end of the film. It goes on. It goes on forever after that chariot. It goes on and on and on, and it's like, come on, just end now already. I don't want to hear all this. I don't watch all this. So I hope Timur sorts that out.
Yeah, sort it out, Timur.
Yeah. And actually makes it the kick-ass action film it should have been.
Correct. Also, good. As much as I think personally that Hiddleston may have dodged a bullet with this, it is interesting to see Jack Houston, who's a man who's been on the cusp, I think, for a long, long time.
Yeah.
He was at one of the movie cons, wasn't he?
He was at one of the movie cons.
Really, Outlander.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's an Outlander. Very hairy.
Yeah. He came in and very, very pleasant. Yeah. Really, really nice guy. One of the great dynasties in Hollywood, of course.
He's brilliant in Boardwalk Empire.
So, yeah, well done, Jack Houston. And maybe it isn't a bullet that you've dodged. Maybe maybe it's going to be great. There's been some really interesting casting news on Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. This week, Matt Smith's joined the cast, hasn't he, Helen?
He has, as Mr. Collins.
Yeah.
And if you know your Pride and Prejudice, you know that Mr. Collins is a dweeb of the highest order and just a grotesque little man. So it's very much a move away from, you know, any attempt to be cool and dashing by the quite cool and quite dashing Doctor.
But I can see that he can be quite dweeby.
I'm not saying he can't do it. I think he'll be very good at it and have loads of fun doing it. But it is definitely not exactly a heartthrob role for him. Weirdly, Sam Riley is Mr. Darcy in this, which feels like slightly odd casting to me.
I can see it, but he hasn't
traditionally played the sort of straight leading man. He's always had a bit of a darker edge. And Mr. Darcy, while stern and so on, is not necessarily a dark character, although of course in this one there are zombies, so hey.
He is presented as quite a dark character, isn't he? He's not the most exactly easygoing fella.
Yeah, he's not smiley, but at the same time he's not sinister, and Sam Riley has a sinister edge for me.
Does he?
Yeah, a little bit.
Really? Okay, yeah. I don't see that myself.
I mean, in a nice way. He's a lovely chap, but yeah. Anyway, got him joining a cast which already includes Douglas Booth, who you just heard, as Mr. Bingley. The one who Elizabeth's older sister Jane falls for.
Who's playing Mr. Bradford?
You're funny. Not really. And then Jack Houston is Mr. Wickham, who's the dashing chap who briefly sort of draws Lizzie's affections. So I don't know, it's a really good cast. I didn't like the book very much. I thought it would have been actually cleverer if you'd just dropped zombies into Pride and Prejudice. But the fact that they then turned the heroes and heroines of Pride and Prejudice into ninjas seemed a little bit nonsensical and distracting and just, you know, stupid to me. But maybe it'll work better on the screen than it did on the page, where it obviously had to contend with actual Jane Austen prose in huge chunks next to these really random little bits of added dojos and so on.
It has always felt to me, as with pretty much everything Seth Graham Smith does, it's felt to me like a geek t-shirt that's got out of hand. But I don't know. I've got to, the cast is very, very good.
Yeah.
It's very, very good. And that could be a good sign that the script is also very, very good as well. So let's keep our minds open,
indeed,
shall we? Keep our brains open and uneaten on Pride and Prejudice and zombies. Speaking of everything being interconnected this week in the world of news, we've mentioned Tom Hiddleston already with Skull Island. Very, very interesting news is, of course, one of Tom Hiddleston's next movies is I Saw the Light, where he's going to play Hank Williams, the famous country and western crooner. And now his on-screen half-brother, Chris Hemsworth, is going to produce and star in a film about the doctor who was involved in the death of Hank Williams. How bizarre. Isn't that bizarre?
I think it's bizarre.
That's Toby Ebersole.
That's so crazy as almost to make me believe that there is indeed a supreme being who manipulates our destinies.
Yeah.
That's astonishing.
It's pretty astonishing. Thor and Loki just can't help going up against each other, can they?
So to speak.
Other big news this week includes the news, as yet completely unconfirmed, that Matthew McConaughey won't be coming back from Magic Mike XXL as Dallas. He won't be getting his abs out. He's a serious actor these days, don't you know, boys? He doesn't have to just get his shirt off.
But hopefully if the role requires it and it isn't gratuitous, like, we'll still get McConaughey abs.
Oh, right. Okay. Yes. That's true. I'm just saying, I am available.
What, as a body double?
Yes. I don't think that's beyond the realms of possibility, do you?
No.
And very, very quickly as well, Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon returning to Bourne. Very interesting news.
Very interesting.
And Frank Marshall has said that it may put the Justin Lin, Jeremy Renner, second Aaron Cross movie on the back burner, perhaps even permanently, which I think would be sad for all concerned, not least the audience.
Well, I mean, Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass have always said that they'd kind of return with each other if the script was good enough. Presumably this means somebody out there has a script good enough, and that's got to be a good sign.
Apparently the idea has come from Greengrass himself and his longtime editor, Chris Rouse.
Well done.
Intriguing. So, I'd love to see a fourth Bourne movie done right. Absolutely.
Maybe they should make both of them at the same time.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, one of them can, like, crash into the other one or something, you know, like at the end of Blazing Saddles.
But that'd be interesting.
You know, they're doing a fight scene.
Screw you, Jeremy Renner's doing a fight grass. Scene.
And they come crashing into it.
That would be very interesting. Yeah. Bourne comes in and just goes, no. Yeah, everyone else skulks off and goes home. And very, very quickly, I've just literally thought of these. Great movie slaps. Hiddleston got me thinking of Thor 2, where Natalie Portman slaps both Loki and Thor. It's a lovely return when they first meet for the first time. I'm not saying it's one of the greatest movie slaps, it's just one that came to me. And then that made me think of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, when Sean Connery slaps Harrison Ford and goes, "Latch for blash for me." And it's just amazing. Latch for 14, yes. No, latch for 14, no.
There you go.
I just like to say yes. And of course, yes, it's me, Evil Dead 2, Bruce Campbell, as Ash slaps himself when his hand gets possessed by the evil. There we go. Thank you very much. Mic drop. Let's have a second guess, shall we?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. It is, of course, an absolute legend. He is to name but a few: Oscar Schindler, Dr. Peyton Westlake, Brian Mills, Aslan, Ra's al Ghul, Qui-Gon Jinn, Rob Roy, Michael Collins, and unforgettably, Keegan from Krull. He is, of course, Liam Bloody Neeson. He's a living embodiment of the mountains of Bourne that sweep down to the sea, the closest thing we have to Finn McCool, and he's added a new name to his list, Private Eye Matthew Scudder, in A Walk Among the Tombstones, a somber adaptation of Lawrence Block's novel. When Neeson came into London recently, I summoned up my courage, increased my accent to nearly impenetrable levels, and sallied forth. Enjoy. Liam Neeson, welcome, sir. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Excellent. You've been challenged to do the Ice Bucket Challenge by Laura Linney. I'm doing one later on today. Have you done yours yet, or are you going to do it?
Michelle Dockery, I've been
really?
Told. Yeah.
Okay.
She's outed me. I was going to do it over the weekend. I have a great scenario. I will do it. I was literally rushing to the airport. I haven't done it yet, but I shall.
Where we are right now in a really posh hotel room is not really the sort of place you can tip a bucket of ice water over your head.
No, my hair's looking really cool.
It's looking pretty damn good, actually, yeah.
But I will do it.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will.
Of course, you know, you filmed The Grey on location, so I imagine the cold is something you can handle fairly easily.
The cold for that film was it nearly broke all our spirits, but we managed it.
Yeah.
I had a great trick, actually, to prepare for that. I used to take very cold showers. I'd start with like 30 seconds and build up to like 6 minutes. Improves your immune system.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Was it lower your core temperature? Or
I think it does. Eventually you do, so that when you're out in the extremes, you can, you're not as badly affected by it.
Well, I'll maybe give it a try. I'm going to have a bucket tipped over my head in about 2 hours.
Oh, you're going to do it? Good.
Yeah, I'm going to do it today, so we'll see how it goes. I love the film, by the way. I was a big fan of the book.
Thank you, man.
As well. Were you aware of the book?
And I'm an avid reader, and I love crime novels, especially all the Nordic noir. I didn't know Lawrence's work at all, Lawrence Block. I've since read 6 or 7 of the novels since we stopped shooting last year, but I was embarrassed. I didn't know. And he's written, as you say, 16, 17 books on this character, Matt Scudder.
And he's even been on the big screen before with Jeff.
He was, Jeff played him, apparently. I didn't see the movie, but yes, he played him.
And I think I read somewhere as well, possibly in Empire magazine, that you were reluctant at first to take this on because you thought it might be just one of those, like another Taken where you were speaking on the bad guys.
I thought there was the inevitable telephone conversation with the bad guy and thought, oh, here we go. But sitting with Scott Frank, the writer, director, totally convinced me that it was almost the opposite of Taken, because the Taken character, Brian Mills, is very, very emotionally invested in finding his daughter.
Hmm.
Whereas this guy is working for heroin traffickers. He's got absolutely no emotional involvement in it at all. You know? So it's almost the opposite of the Taken character.
Absolutely. And of course you get beaten up in this one as well. He's more vulnerable, I would say, than Brian Mills. Brian Mills is a one-man army, this guy.
Yes.
Scudder is not.
He's a wee bit, yeah. It was hard to... I've been working with this guy, Mark Vanslow, who's my stunt coordinator for 16 movies.
Right.
And in Tombstones, it's like I have to take a bit of a beating in one altercation, and it was not sitting with me well at all, you know.
There's a few books, as you said, and you've read about 6 or 7 of them. There's a lot more than that as well to come, I imagine, lined up on your bed.
Well, listen, people have been asking me. I mean, if the film performs well, as they say in America, certainly I would love to do it again. I know Scott Frank would, and I know Larry Block would. He'd love it to be a series of films. You never know, you know. Mm. Maybe on television it might work better, actually. HBO or one of those really cool cable channels, you know.
That'd be interesting. Can you see yourself doing that? Because TV is much more, I guess, palatable these days for movie actors.
It's more than palatable. It's also attracting the best writing.
Yeah.
Because the authors have a chance to explore characters and situations over a longer period of time. If you're writing for the cinema, you get a 2-hour window. That's about the length of the film, you know. Mm. Yeah, some of these cable channels are attracting, and have done for several years now, the best writing.
So watch this space, maybe? Is that what you're...
Well, as I'm talking to you, I'm just having the idea, you know, that
if
the studios don't want to get into those novels, maybe there's an opening on HBO or something to devise a series, you know?
That would be fun. I was talking to Olivia Megaton this week about Taken 3, and... just no one really knows much about that film at the moment, so he filled me in a little bit. Just wanted to get your take on it. He said it's not like the other two. It's more like The Fugitive.
Uh-huh.
Can you shed any light on that?
I guess that's a good little pared-down description of the overall feel of the film, you know? I don't want to give anything away about it. There's certainly a few thrills and spills, and an amazing car chase down the wrong direction on a highway.
Very good.
Los Angeles, that when I think about it, it still makes me shake.
And how involved? How much of the driving were you doing yourself?
I wasn't actually driving the vehicle, but I was in the vehicle.
Okay.
For all of it. And I get dizzy on a thick carpet, so
yeah,
you know, rides at fairgrounds and stuff like that, forget it. Just signed up to do a film called Suspension, hanging from bridge in New York, George Washington Bridge.
For the whole movie?
Pretty much.
Okay. But they can do it with green screen. You can be on just like a little ledge.
That's true. Be fine. Yeah. But there's some shots that, like, it's not that I want to do a Tom Cruise thing, you know. Tom loves doing all that stuff. I can't do that stuff. Tom.
Yeah, it's crazy. This year has been very interesting for me watching you, because I think you've embraced your Northern Irishness on the big screen in a way that you haven't done in the past. In terms of Bill Marx in Nonstop was born in Belfast.
Yes.
And of course, the Lego Movie.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Good cop, bad cop. The good cop voice, it fascinates me. Loved it. Where did the good cop voice come from for you?
We were creating it on the spot. I was doing stuff with Will Farrell, who was in Los Angeles
mm-hmm.
in front of a microphone. I was in New York in front of a microphone, and we were bantering back
and forth.
That's
slightly weird, dislocated way.
And to get involved in an improv session with Will Farrell is like stepping into the ring with Mike Tyson. It's like terrifying. And he was just going off script all the time, brilliantly, because he's an amazing comedian. And I can't, I'm not, you know. So when we got to little good cop, bad cop stuff, it was just on the spot trying to do something. The opposite of this wee surly Northern Ireland bad cop.
So how he came. Out again.
We just came out of fear.
Good cop is motivated entirely by fear.
Yeah.
I like it. Do you do it at parties?
No. But it's a funny film, isn't it?
It's a great film.
It's really funny.
It is fantastic. One of the interesting things about Walk Among the Tombstones, again, I mean, you mentioned it, and the Taken movies, are the phone conversations, talking to bad guys.
Yes.
What's the secret for you of good phone acting? Do you need someone on the other end of the line? Do you imagine it? How do you do it?
Well, in both cases, I had in the first take, and I remember we shot it in this very grotty little apartment, supposed to be my character's apartment, in Los Angeles. And Maggie Grace, who plays my daughter, was stuck in the corner over there. So, so it was I was acting with her, which was terrific. Tombstones, I have a conversation with one of the bad guys and lovely, wonderful actor, David. And he was in another room, so he was there, very present, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I wasn't just speaking into the ether, you know.
Okay. Do you have to psych yourself up to get into a threatening mindset? For example, that famous monologue in Taken. Do you have to? How do you build yourself up to that?
Not really. I was. Yeah, I remember the one in Taken. We did it in like three takes, and I was just very conscious of just not overdoing it. You know, you're aware it's your daughter, but you're also a professional and you're trying to keep your emotions very much in check, you know. And in the Tombstones one, there's no emotion involved whatsoever, because you know you're dealing with sickos, you know.
One last thing, Lima, before I let you go, is the I was watching again today your amazing cameo in Life's Too Short,
yeah.
Which is hilarious. And it's interesting. I wrote down a list. I made a list of the list you brought in with the things that you wanted to do comedically. Improv, stand-up comedy, funny monologues, crazy characters, sketches, slapstick, anecdotes, and parody. Now, almost 3 years on, how many of those have you done? And what do you still feel you need to brush up on?
The anecdotes are okay.
You're good for those?
Any number of those.
Yeah.
Oh, stand-up comedy. Yeah,
would you ever do it? Could you ever do it?
I could not do that.
No.
It's terrifying, right?
Yeah, I imagine it would be.
And yet, we've lost Robin Williams, and a genius at stand-up comedy, like an absolute genius. I sometimes asked him, I was in his company a few times. I can't say we were friends, but because I didn't know him that well. But I was in his company a few times, and he would sometimes talk about it, and he just got so high. That was his thing, you know. If there were more than two people in a room, he'd be off. It was incredible. I shared a bus with him once. We were coming back from somewhere into Canada, and we were being dropped off at our various hotels, and there was Harrison Ford, Michael Douglas, myself, Danny DeVito.
That's a hell of a bus.
Robin, and there was a couple other people.
Right.
And Robin started on, I don't know what you would call it, there's no word for it. He just started riffing on George Bush for maybe 10, good 12 minutes, and it was an iambic pentameter.
Really?
I kid you not.
Oh my God.
And we all sort of looked at each other and thought, this must be maybe what Shakespeare could have been like. Seriously, this stuff just pouring out of him. And Robin was like that. And we were coming back from somewhere. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning.
Oh my God.
And he just started and this stuff. It was like, where does it come from?
You know? Yeah.
Brilliant.
He was just feeding off the energy. As everyone
just
else
feeding
as
off
well.
The energy. Yeah. And he had an audience, you know. A very trapped audience too.
I'm sure at no point did you want to get out.
Amazing.
When Robin
then there was, I must tell you this other thing too. Yeah. At the same time, we all had, we were in a restaurant. I was doing a picture with Harrison, and I was his date that night. Michael Douglas was there. Anyway, it was the same troupe, a few more people. Hmm. And Mike Douglas's telephone went, and it was his father, Kirk Douglas. So I could hear him go, "Hey, Pops. Da-da-da, chap. Hey, Pops, I'm going to pass you around the table. Some people want to say hi." And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to get a chance to talk to Kirk Douglas.
Yeah.
So the telephone was passed around. I eventually get and say, "Mr. Douglas, my name is Liam Neeson. Loved your films. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I hope you're well, sir." Harrison said something, and Robin was sitting beside Harrison. Well, he grabs the phone, and he starts on this riff about Spartacus. "I'm Spartacus. I'm the real Spartacus. You're a fake." He does this whole thing. All the lines from Spartacus. You could hear Kirk Douglas guffawing with laughter. And eventually, Michael, his son, had to reach for the phone, pull it out of Robin's hand and say, "Robin, he's going to take a heart attack." And he was... Kirk Douglas is now 95, so he was in his 80s.
Oh my God.
But his face was red. He said, "Give me it. He's going to take a heart attack."
Yeah, yeah.
You could hear this man guffawing with laughter at Robin's spiel, you know?
Extraordinary. Extraordinary.
What a fucking loss. Huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you've never been tempted yourself then to get on the stage and do it yourself? Never?
No.
No?
My God, are you joking?
There's lots of open mic slots in London, Liam. Lots of places to take it. The Comedy Store? No. You walked on, you'd kill it.
I'm about as funny as a baby with a razor blade.
It's a good line in which to end. It's a good line. Liam, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so
much.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Thanks.
Nick Desemlian told me this week that there was news that Liam, and I did the interview a couple weeks ago, Liam, as he likes us to call him, is writing a movie with Bono. Is this, have you guys heard about this? Apparently he's writing a screenplay with Bono.
I have not heard this, no.
Huh.
But that would be interesting.
It would be interesting.
Yes.
It'd be mega Catholic.
I checked my iPad today. There wasn't anything in the movies folder, so they obviously haven't finished it yet. Right, so talk of Big Liam means we should start with A Walk Among the Tombstones.
Yes.
Dan,
yes.
You reviewed it for Empire Magazine.
I did review it.
Can you set it up for the people at home?
So it's based on the Lawrence Block... it's based on kind of... Lawrence Block's done a series about Matthew Scudder, mm-hmm. who's an unlicensed private eye and ex-cop. So it's... It's taken mostly from the book Walk Among the Tombstones, but I think there might be elements of the other books. I'm not massively familiar with the books. I will hold my hands up and be honest about that. But he's a good character. He's an interesting character. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like a proper private eye who gets, you know, doesn't punch his way out of situations.
There's
he talks of, his way out of situations.
There's a lot of legwork as well.
He does legwork. Yeah. He does, you know, talking to people on the street. And the film makes a virtue of that. But he gets drawn into this... I'm not sure how much I really want to give away, but basically this guy pulls him in and says that his wife's been kidnapped and also horrifically murdered, but he can't go to the police because the guy's whose wife has been murdered is a drug trafficker. And he's played by Dan Stevens.
Dan Stevens,
yes.
our current spirit animal.
Yes.
Not topless, I have to say.
No.
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 Sure
no. But he's very good. He's very good in it. And so he draws Scudder in, and Scudder has to investigate who are these people or person who are taking these loved ones of these criminals. And it's a really, really dark, murky film. It does have lighter moments in it, and it's kind of self-aware in the sense that it sort of tackles the cliches of the private eye genre quite honestly. I did enjoy those elements, but mostly I just thought Neeson was perfect for the role. Really sort of playing this really smart guy. He's got a skeleton in his closet. You know, there's a dark past and the film does hark back to that. And we open in that past and the character we're seeing is almost like more the kind of character we're used to Liam Neeson playing now.
Yeah.
these sort of, you know, big swaggering action guys.
Unstoppable one-man armies.
Exactly. And it plays on that a bit. And now we're seeing him, you know, this is 10 years later. And it's actually set, another thing I liked about it was the setting. Mm. It's set in 1999, just before the millennium. And there's all these things talking about Y2K and everything's going to come crashing down. People are worrying about planes falling out of the sky. And it's really weird. It's almost got this odd millennial tension kind of vibe to it, which feeds really well. And one of the, characters in it says, people are afraid of all the wrong things. And I think that's one of those kind of very telling lines.
That's the tagline, I believe, as well.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
I really enjoyed it. It's quite slow. It's not a big action film. It's very, very talky.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed it, and mainly because of Mr. Neeson. And I like seeing him do this rather than do that.
Yeah, I'm fully on board with you as well. I'd read the novel before. I think it's a really, really good novel. I think Scudder's a really interesting character. Mm. And it's a very good adaptation. It cuts a couple of characters from the novel, most notably Scudder's love interest in the book, who's a prostitute. But yeah, it's got some lovely stuff in here. It's a character piece for me, more than say a Taken or a Non-Stop. It's in many ways the anti-Taken.
Yeah,
I thought
that's what I said in my review.
Yeah, even though it features Liam Neeson on the phone threatening bad guys.
Indeed, yeah, it's amazing seeing that scene, but played, you know, for grown-ups.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he does get a beating in this movie. He's not unstoppable, but he's also got this real kind of lived-in cool, I think, which really, really works for the character, who has, of course, been on the big screen before, played by Jeff Bridges in 8 Million Ways to Die.
Yeah.
I would like to see this become a series. I think it's like the Jack Reacher series with Tom Cruise. They're never going to break the box office wide open, but they're going to be relatively cheap, I think, to make. And if you make one every 2 years or so, you could make three or four before they got a bit too old to do it. And I'd be quite happy to see that happen. Yeah. Some really nice character work. It is grim. It is very, very somber. Yes. Very, very violent. The bad guys in this are very bad indeed.
There's some proper nasty stuff in it. But it's not torture porn exploitative at all. It's proper nasty.
Written, directed by Scott Frank. I do think he has a few flourishes towards the end stylistically that don't quite work. But yeah, I would happily see more of this. 4 stars we gave to Walk Among the Tombstones. Mm. Do go and see. Next up, Helen, The Riot Club.
Yes, this is based on the play Posh, as you mentioned earlier when you were introducing the interview. And it is the story of, it essentially focuses on two young men who've just gone up to Oxford. Max Irons and Sam Claflin are the ones playing them. Both from very fancy backgrounds, frankly, both from very aristocratic, wealthy backgrounds. And they're trying to sort of find their place in college, fit in, get to grips with everything. They don't particularly like each other. At least Sam Claflin takes against Max Irons pretty early on. They are both invited to join this riot club, which we see has been going since the 17th century. It's a secret dining society devoted to decadence and relying on the people involved being extremely rich and extremely well-heeled in order to keep them from really having to face the consequences of their actions. It all builds towards the club's sort of annual dinner, where the 10 members, it's limited to 10, get together at feast, drink a lot, and I don't know if we can call it being merry, but they certainly let loose, let's say. And on this occasion, things get even more out of hand than they are designed to do. And that's where other characters come in. Holiday Granger plays the sort of girl from a slightly more normal background who Max Irons develops a little bit of a relationship with. Jessica Brown Findlay is a waitress in the restaurant where they hold this dinner. They've been banned from every restaurant around Oxford. This is sort of, you know, 20 or 30 miles away that they have to go. And also Natalie Dormer of Game of Thrones turns up briefly as an escort who is hired. It's all very well played. Really good performances, I think, from everybody involved. I think they've softened the edges a little bit from the play. It was adapted for the screen by Laura Wade, who wrote it.
Did you see the play?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is brilliant. Yeah. But I feel like they've softened the edges. They've given us someone slightly more sympathetic to kind of root for. And it doesn't quite have the punch that the play had. The play was pretty much all at this one dinner. And they've kind of, you know, lost that focus by sort of taking it out to Oxford, to the colleges, mm-hmm. widening it out to their story there. So we gave it 3 stars, which is probably right, but it is actually, it's a really fascinating film. You will come out wanting to punch a Tory, which is always fun.
And you come it out of every film wanting to punch a Tory.
Well, yeah. I go into every film wanting to punch a fucking Tory.
But, hey, but you want to punch a Tory more this time. And it actually would make, genuinely, it would make a great, great double bill with Pride. We recommended that very highly last week. I think a lot of people haven't listened to us because it hasn't gone, you know, amazingly well at the cinema so far. But seriously, The Riot Club followed by Pride would be a genuinely great double bill about the UK, if that is still the country we're living in when you listen to this. So yeah, definitely, I would personally really recommend it, even with its faults, because I think it's just really well written and very, very clever.
Okay, excellent. 3 stars then for The Riot Club. And then we're going to move on very, very swiftly to the Woodmeister, Woody Allen. His latest film, his 937th film in known history, Magic in the Moonlight, which stars Colin Firth as a skeptic, a professional skeptic, who's trying to debunk Emma Stone's medium. I would say she's more of a small myself, which is a good joke.
Is it?
No.
Okay. Yeah, it's this is Woody Allen kind of maybe coasting a little bit. This is not him on Blue Jasmine form. This is not the biting and sort of incisive Woody. I mean, which is not necessarily a bad thing. There's a lot to be said for Woody Allen just sort of having fun and being charming on the French Riviera, especially with such likeable stars as Colin Firth and Emma Stone. I mean, who doesn't love one or both of them? It's completely crazy. But at the same time, there's not much to it here. This is a bit light-weighted. It's not terribly compelling, I think. So yeah, we gave it 3 stars. You know, nice, but not essential Allen.
Indeed. As our review says, Stone is a delight. But then when isn't she? When isn't she a delight? Honestly. 3 stars for that. It's a good week at the multiplexes this week. Fairly crowded, and obviously arthouse cinemas as well. 20,000 Days on Earth is the interesting Nick Cave documentary that's not a Nick Cave documentary. Nick Cave's in it. Kylie Minogue's in it. Ray Winston's in it. Not as a giant floating head. We gave that 4 stars. There's also Grand Piano, which is a bonkers De Palma-esque thriller starring Elijah Wood as a concert pianist threatened by a killer, played by John Cusack, during a concert. And that is well worth your time. 3 stars for that as well. And 3 stars also for Zach Braff's controversial, partly Kickstarter-funded Wish I Was Here.
Does Grand Piano hit all the right notes?
It certainly does, but not necessarily in the right order. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week when I will be 1 year older. Hint, guys, what have you got me?
I think Dan was going to get you something.
Yeah.
Weren't you?
Yeah, of course. Mm. Yeah, it's really, really, really substantial.
Good. Go out and get it wrapped. We'll also be joined by Antoine Fuqua, director of The Equalizer, and the legend that is Lee Child, the creator of Jack Reacher, pops into the pod booth to finally answer the burning question, which animal, when fired out of a cannon, do you think you could catch? To find it out, download next week's Empire Podcast when it appears. If that doesn't have you staring impatiently at the podcast page on iTunes, waiting for the new episode to appear, then frankly nothing will. Until then, until that glorious day, it's goodbye from Dan.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to force these guys to sing Happy Birthday to me. Sing it.
Happy birthday to
not that one! Oh, Dan, you idiot.